Welcome to the 8th installment of the Polycast Side Series Evergreen. I'm Wouter Locutus-Snijders. The series' 8th season consisted of 27 episodes, including its landmark 200th and a special. As with the previous seven evergreens, Polycast regular co-host Daniel Denkew Quick selected and ranked the 10 topics he feels most retain their relevance years after they were first published. As well, recurring guest co-host Canis Albinus re-listened to the entire season to select the 10 most representative moments for the show alongside an honorable mention. Hold on to your hats, it's about to get windy. Number 10 from episode 200. Enter in this lesson the Civ 5 sequel to the Civ 2 I Disagree, Sire from season 4.
I am your economic advisor. I'll teach you how cities work, how to found new cities, and where the best places are to build them.
I'm your foreign advisor. We'll learn the basics of diplomacy with other civilizations and city-states.
I'm your military advisor. I'll teach you how to stomp out barbarians and destroy their camps, and how to conquer an enemy civilization's city.
I am your science advisor. I'll teach you how to move your units around the map. In the process, you'll discover ancient ruins, natural wonders, and whole new continents.
This is a good place to found a city. Food and resources are plentiful here.
We have succeeded. Oh, happy day.
Our treasury is depleted, and we need new sources of gold.
Consider sending your warrior out to explore new territory.
You should seriously consider this. The art of combat is important to learn, even for the most peaceful leader.
I have a bad feeling about this.
Now this is a happy circumstance. Ancient ruins hold secrets that may advance our civilization.
Interesting. This could lead to a breakthrough. Technology is science put to use. We should investigate this.
You may want to consider this.
Excuse me, I have a bad feeling about this.
Now this is a happy circumstance. The sun shines brightly on our lands. You may find this to be useful. Our treasury has grown, and we have money to spend.
Aha! Fortune smiles broadly on us.
Oh, happy day.
Wonderful! The sun shines brightly on our lands.
I have some information that may be of use. The land near your city could be made more productive. Build a worker to improve your territory.
Here is something that may be helpful.
Excuse me.
This situation requires decisive action.
Under your command, your workers will build trade routes to collect gold, construct improvements to help your cities grow, build things quicker, and improve resources to make our people happier.
You may want to consider this.
We have succeeded. We have a worker, but have not improved any tiles yet. The worker can improve tiles in our territory.
You should seriously consider this.
Order your worker to construct an improvement on a tile to gain an economic benefit.
If I may speak freely, things are not going well. We have no combat units defending our territory. It is a dangerous world, and we are vulnerable to attack.
These are dire times. You may want to consider this.
Workers are defenseless. It may be best to reconsider our strategy. We use extreme caution when moving them outside our borders.
Excuse me. We may be able to manage this more efficiently. Our capital city has finished building a unit.
Now, this is a happy circumstance. You now have a ranged unit.
Clever move.
Our smart moves have been paying dividends.
Oh, happy day.
One of your combat units is near an enemy unit.
If I may interrupt, I have a bad feeling about this.
You need to know this. The enemy unit you are near is fortified.
This attack will damage both sides evenly.
Things are not going well.
We have a unit that is on the verge of being destroyed.
You need to know this.
You may want to reconsider this attack.
We have succeeded. Thanks to our military victories, a great general has come forth.
The sun shines brightly on our lands.
Fascinating. We have succeeded.
I think we have enough workers for the moment.
You have a unit that hasn't moved for a while.
Our workers are idle. You may want to construct something else. Our capital has grown into a bustling city. It may be time to build a settler to found another.
Clever move. We have succeeded.
Now this is a happy circumstance. The sun shines brightly on our lands.
This situation requires decisive action. You can found a new city with your settler. Move to a fertile location and found a new city.
If I may interrupt, your settler is alone outside your borders and could be captured.
You may want to consider this.
You need to know this. Your people are no longer happy. An unhappy populace will not grow as fast as a content one. If you wish to make your citizens happier, order your workers to build improvements on resources.
I have some information that may be of use.
Natural wonders are hidden around the world. Discovering them makes your civilization happier.
Knowing this, we may want to change our tactics.
You should found your city soon.
You should seriously consider this.
Our treasury is depleted, and we need new sources of gold. This is a good place to found a city. Workboats allow you to improve fish and whale resources off your coast.
Having a strong navy is the only way to defend and explore the oceans around us.
Excuse me, I have some information that may be of use. You have discovered a city-state. A city-state has requested your assistance. Things are not going well.
This situation requires decisive action.
Here is something that may be helpful. This is a complicated subject with a great deal of nuance. City-states are small countries that are not competing to win the game. You may interact with them diplomatically, or you may go to war with them.
I have some information that may be of use. Thanks to your research, all of your future military units will possess the embark promotion and can move across the water. You should seriously consider this.
Great Scott!
This situation requires decisive action.
Here are some more tactics for you to consider. We could push this situation to our advantage.
If I may interrupt, there is more than one way to become the greatest civilization and win the game.
I have some information that may be of use. You can upgrade obsolete units, turning them into more powerful units by spending gold.
If I may interrupt, things are not going well. We are spending all of our money on maintenance. You can spend money in a number of ways. You should seriously consider this.
Cities can be tough to capture, like military units can defend against attackers. Cities can bombard besiegers.
Siege units are excellent at knocking out cities from range.
I have a bad feeling about this.
This may affect our diplomatic standing.
You need to know this.
We failed.
Number 9 from episode 196. The best settling duo from Hill, River, and Mountain Tiles in Civilization V covers some ground.
The River, Mountain, and Hill trilemma, Saga X, states in his thread, In some of my games, I encounter this kind of spot when selling a new city. A hill, a river, and a mountain are located in a way that you can only use two of them for their full benefit. This means, one, you can settle on the hill adjacent to a river, but the mountain will be one tile away, thus denying the observatory. Two, you can settle on the hill adjacent to the mountain, but the river will not be next to the city, thus denying all river-based buildings. And three, you can settle next to both river and mountain, but on a flat tile with lower production. Assuming this is the third or fourth city, and your choice won't affect your reach to crucial resources, where would you pop the suburb?
That qualification in that last sentence is very important in answering this question.
Yes, because if it's your capital city, you're going on the hill,
yeah.
Whether it's next to the mountain or not. If it's not, then we're going to go next to the mountain and the river.
With the capital city, you went on the hill river. If it's third or fourth city, I still go with the hill river. I mean, the observatory is nice, but for me, it's not a priority. To me, I think you get a lot more out of the river with all the river-based buildings that you can build. And, of course, the hill gives that extra bonus with the defense and production and everything. So, for me, it's a no-brainer, and I voted on the little poll that they have there, hill and river.
But we can also see from the poll is that rivers are superior.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, nobody doesn't want a river.
One person did.
One person wanted the hill mountain.
Uh-huh.
I'm pretty sure that was a misclick.
Or at least Dan hopes you misclicked.
River and Mountain has 64% of the vote, and Hill and River has 33%, and that one vote for Hill and Mountain amounts to two.
Aw.
Yes, I'll go for the Hill River.
Well, capital...
It depends on what civ you are, too, whether you want that extra science from the observatory.
Oh, yeah, if this was capital, this would be, I'd be like...
Yeah, Hill, River, no-brainer?
No.
I'd take River, Mountain.
Mm-hmm. I would take River, Mountain, too, because then you get the observatory, because your capital is likely going to be your science, and that'll give you, yeah. You know, your science source. Those listening wondering what's with the observatory, plus 50% science, no maintenance available at Renaissance, but the city must be next to a mountain.
And it stacks with the National College, which is 99% of the time going to be in your capital. So I'll take River Mountain, as long as the territory around it isn't horrible to defend the city, because cities on not hills, bad.
That's one thing. With a hill and mountain or something next to a mountain, one time that I will do that is if I see a good strategic defensive location, where it's like maybe at a mountain pass and whatnot, where I can just put a city there, may have resources worth me grabbing, but it makes it difficult for another civilization to come in and attack that city because they basically have to line up their troops to come in, and I can just take them down one by one as opposed to coming in from all sides.
Yeah, it really does depend on what the map looks like. If it's a single mountain tile in the middle of flat area, then that's going to suck a lot more than if it's like a massive mountain range protecting everything.
And if you're playing as the Inca, too, I can see going for hill and mountain, because then those terrace farms are really going to make up for the missing river if there's a lot of mountains around.
That is true.
Yep. So this is a question of, do you want to dodge the river-based buildings? Because, I mean, with no money on a river... All you're really doing is going for the extra farm, but you don't have to be on the river. You just need the river close to you to get the extra food.
And the extended trade routes in the early game.
Yeah, that's true. Trade route bonus.
Extra food can equal eventually extra money, extra anything else, basically. The more people you have, the more production you have and everything, theoretically. Kind of a rock, paper, scissors thing again.
Mm-hmm. Although I love this. Celiandra said in the thread, the one that is most defensible, hill and mountain. But then I go and check the who voted, and they didn't vote for Hill and Mountain.
And that's a misclick.
Yep.
CPM 4001 in the thread said, I'd say it depends entirely on the surrounding resources. Settle wherever nets you the most resources.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily. You say it depends entirely on the surrounding resources? No, I think it'd say depend heavily on the surrounding resources. It's in part, what do you see the purpose of that city doing?
Yeah, let's think. Is this a mountain hill in the middle of vast jungle? Then yes, I will please take that observatory. If not, eh?
Observatory with the university in the jungle?
Yep. Yep. Even if it doesn't have the National College, it's still well worth getting that 50%.
Number 8 from episode 195. The temperature of reception for could-be global warming in the Civ series is variable.
Maybe we can add global warming back. No? There's no groans of, surprise.
And well, no, because global warming back doesn't necessarily mean it would be like we've had in previous Civ titles. If it was, let's get global warming back the way it was, no, then I would groan.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, that's not nice things to say.
All back over on Reddit again. Lego Moan. The idea that now that everybody was talking about the spearmint thing.
Before you go on, Mackie, I think it's fair to say that we can consider this global warming even if we don't consider this alternate map implementation.
Just a bunch of hot air?
Yes.
If I set aside the fact that they're basing it off of the sphere type that we just talked about, I actually am liking this topic more.
Yeah, if you throw out the whole basic concept that he starts with, yeah.
Well, his sure. It's not the premise.
Anyway, he does agree that the original Civ 4 version was kind of lame, which we know. But with a spherical map and more powerful computers, it would be cool to see the ecological effects of global warming, industrialization, and even nuclear war after the industrial age. In Civ, of course, not real life, he points out. Oh, some of the things. The ice caps could get smaller, and oceans would rise. Now, I see the oceans rising to be a little problematic because a lot of people are going to have coastal cities.
And he does point out later on, if your city happens to be on the coast, bye-bye city.
Yeah, I hope you didn't need that.
I have fundamental gripes with this coaster.
Yeah, the coastal
and
thing,
I think
no,
that this kind of design is awful in strategy game. If you are making a game and you are calling it a strategy game, putting in a mechanic that you're virtually guaranteed to encounter without much control over it whatsoever that will completely ruin an equalized strategy is a bad design element. There's nothing good about that kind of stuff. Having your cities disappear because at the end of the game, without really anything you can do to control it, is crap in strategy, especially if cities still carry the value they have throughout the Civ series. If they're, like, not valuable at all, then that's different, but then we're really getting away from what Civ has been to this point.
Okay, oceans rising. Oceans are always rising or falling and rising and falling. Cities don't go away with it. Seriously, over the course of history, there's certain areas have seen issues, but yeah, they've dealt with it. And it's not like oceans rising multiple feet.
It's not like they rise 10 feet over a year or something crazy like that.
Yeah, well, I mean, they can, but then we're probably all dead anyways by that point for other reasons.
I mean, there's definitely some potential, something you could do more minor that would be interesting.
Ice caps getting smaller and revealing a little bit more land or something like that, that's not a bad thing. There's another one in his list here about some of the tundra being replaced eventually.
Tundra and taiga doesn't really give way to grasslands and plains.
They technically already are grasslands and plains. They're just cold grasslands and plains kind of-ish. Taiga, at least, I think.
Tundra is just desert. That's really, really...
Now, we don't need the storms and hurricanes, though.
Well, I take that more as just have weather. So it would be like if there's a hurricane flowing through a certain area, then your planes wouldn't have the range. Movement would be a little harder. Combat would be less damaging.
It doesn't fit the model. It doesn't work. Unless you're changing the time scale, you can't model that. There are no 20-year hurricanes.
Well, obviously.
There's not even a hurricane that lasts a full year. It doesn't fit the scope of the game to model that with a direct in-game tactical effect.
I think something like that could work so long as there was, tying back to your point earlier, Philip Oaks, choices in strategy games, so long as there was something, as soon as that's introduced in the game, that you could do either something to counteract it to some degree, or when it came across that you were given a choice, even if it was like a crappy and a crappier choice, so long as there was some kind of connection to what you did or didn't do up to that point in the game, and then when the event happened that you were presented with the opportunity to make another choice, depending upon the degree of these choices and effects, I'd be okay with it.
Yes, I agree with you there.
It kind of goes back to random events in Civ 4, and of course we can't talk about this without talking about random events.
I agree with you there, but what it cannot become and what it often does in strategy games is a false choice, where your strategies that will either cause it or not cause it are consistently the same, in that your alternative is just so crappy that you would never pick it, even despite the penalties, and then it's the same thing with your event quote-unquote choice. If it's something where you can, once you're an experienced player, always just click a certain option without thinking about it, you have a bad design element.
Yeah.
Well, then that's gone the other way.
But that happens a lot with this kind of quote-unquote event or this kind of function in the game.
Yeah, I know you're talking about both extremes, right? Either, oh, there's nothing I can do, or there's something I always can do, so therefore I'm not thinking about it.
Yeah. Neither of those.
But both have the exact same answer, though. If the player just goes bleep and doesn't even think, then it's not dreaded G.
Nope.
It's just in-game. Then again, I mean, there is a place for just purely in-game stuff that has just stuff happens, period. Even in strategy games. It's a time scale thing. I mean, if this was U4 that had per day thing, then yes, hurricanes should happen. Storms could happen.
Tactical control there is different, too.
Yeah.
It's a different game. It's a different design. You're not covering, human history in its entirety. You're covering a couple hundred years.
Yeah. But also, even just on the scale of things, I would be okay with migrating animals.
Yeah, that was one of the suggestions, that the animals and plants either disappearing or going to a different area.
Every resource disappeared.
But even migrating animals, I mean, I'd be okay with that in the concept of it, because if you have that, then you could also extend it to the point where you can move where the animals are. So if you want an area to be farm rich with lots of cows, and maybe there's horses off in the far distance and you want to go get them so you can produce horse units, and then you have the migration and or be able to move them, then that could be a better mechanic.
Yeah, because it probably surprises people that cows are not native to Texas.
If they move another in another source, if that happened to be a tile, for example, in your city, then you could get a dialogue prompt to say, hey, there are now cows on this particular tile. Do you want to move the nearest worker there to go then improve it for a pasture? So you've been notified that, A, this has actually happened, and B, give the player a choice to actually start using that or not using that. And they could decide, you know, at this point, no, I don't want my worker to dispatch doing that. It's currently constructing a mine on this frickin' aluminum I just found. I'll do it later.
Can you imagine the posts about this where, they tend up their animals and are breeding them and are, taking care of them, and they just uncontrollably move thousands of
No, the moment you put them in a pasture, they wouldn't migrate.
Okay. I mean,
all those resources that are outside of everybody's tile city range now could actually migrate into the city or be migrated into instead.
Yeah, that'd be more the point.
I will say, though, from this initial list of things that could happen in terms of the ecological effects, at the very end, deserts would expand. Yet earlier he said, you know, random tiles around the world turning into useless desert, which is kind of lame. So the desert's going to expand, and where is it going to expand to? Is it suddenly going to be desert in your ocean then, in which case it then didn't take away from a tile that you were... I don't understand that.
No, existing deserts have the adjacent hexades become deserts, yes, rather than, some random desert appearing in the middle of a tropical rainforest and then not expanding, just that they just have a random drop.
If you got Sahara, and maybe the Sahara would get bigger.
Yeah.
Which is happening in real life. Deserts get bigger as they slowly get bigger.
That's true, but is that fun gameplay-wise? Is that...
Who cares?
What do you mean, who cares?
If you're Marco.
We already covered it. It depends how it's modeled.
If a desert adds one hex, every 50 turns to it, that's early game, a really long time before that happens. Late game, then it happens a lot more often.
If that doesn't start triggering until after somebody hits industrialization, of course.
I'm pretty sure desertification happens.
Well, it happens without it, but yeah, I know.
And then there's also this little thing about changing the victory conditions a little, which, I raised the Spock eyebrow.
Well,
they could use it. There's no harm in that.
Maybe the science fiction could involve you researching ecotex to stop global warming. Well, Alpha Centauri's tradition at this point. Although having more techs to help you against global warming in that later part of the tech tree would not be bad.
It's a fairly obvious point. You go from moon landing to Alpha Centauri with no step in between. Yes, that's been part of the game forever, but other steps like going to Mars or something else along that line first might not be a bad thing to slow down the tech victory once you get to that point. Because I'm pretty sure we can't build a spaceship that goes to Alpha Centauri yet.
No, I know, but we also can't live for, the 6,000 years that this game spans either. So,
hey, we're already in the info era, so game terms-wise, we're there. Of course, we don't have giant death robots yet.
Darn it.
I don't think we will, just from a practicality.
Yeah.
plane, but you know.
That's a different argument.
The risk of this being like freaking off topic cast, I can see our descendants in 1,000 years going, do you see how they used to refer to that as the information age?
Information dark age, maybe.
Maybe one final point on this. It actually came as a response in the thread on Reddit from Ermigerd Space. Part of the reason, yes, wanted to mention this quote was to be able to say it in that way. But anyway, he's like, ties into not just this topic, but the one before, which is part of our research lab, where we look at things that are not in Civ yet, but maybe in the future. Or in some cases, things that were in Civ in the past, and maybe they should be brought back in some way or not. I've not even seen Civ 6 officially announced yet, and we're already seeing a lot of suggestions from people who aren't developing the game to other people who aren't developing the game. Did I miss the big post where Firaxis decided to crowdsource development? Or are we all just wasting a lot of time and effort on ideas that will have literally no impact on the next game? If the game isn't in development, the discussion is irrelevant. If it is in development, they're not going to rewrite the game engine because of a Reddit post. Whoa, really?
Somebody got up on the wrong side of the coffee pot.
I can think of a few things in that statement that are actually wrong.
Yeah. Thank you. I don't know if it's actually serious. I've never seen this person before. I wouldn't say that. I've read it. It may be a complete troll post, but it is so well written. And actually, Lego Moan responded, which, if we are going to take it seriously, he pointed out that this is actually the Civ subreddit, not the Civ 5 subreddit.
That's right.
And besides, when you're talking about Civilization 5, I don't know how you cannot be talking about a Civilization 6. Just like if we were talking about Civilization 1, when people talked about Civilization 1, they would end up talking about Civ 2.
And you can never tell where the devs are lurking and reading.
Yeah, exactly.
Number 7 from episode 202. A critique of what the Civ series contributes to gaming brings about much opposition.
There is a YouTube video regarding Civilization by Errant Signal, and apparently the premise of the channel is to look at different types of games. It points out the differences between what the games assert themselves to be versus what they actually are, and also the kinds of messages that the games send.
As a kid, I always felt I was learning something, from key scientific breakthroughs to which leaders went with which civilizations. But as an adult, I see the underlying rhetoric at play here, the assumptions baked into its metaphors, and the arguments being put forth by its mechanics. And while I still absolutely adore the game, I do so now with an understanding that it's not showing the actual patterns of history, but patterns of a specific lens through which it views history.
I was pretty interested by some of the things. Like, it points out the whole conceptualization of barbarians in the Civ games.
The mechanical point of barbarians is to spice up early gameplay and force players to keep at least a small military available, since barbarians could attack at any moment, whether or not you're at war with anyone. But that's sort of the problem. Unlike other quote-unquote civilized societies, barbarians don't obey territory boundaries and can't be reasoned with. The game paints them basically as monsters. Actually, in Alpha Centauri, the barbarian stand-ins literally are monsters in the form of terror-inducing mindworms, which provide pretty much the same purpose and underscore how dehumanized the barbarians really are. Civilization 4 even goes so far as to have the barbarians share a banner with wildlife, as if to imply they're on the same side, as if they were destructive forces of nature and not really people at all. With the barbarian mechanic, Civilization effectively comes out and says that while there are many civilizations of all colors and creeds, there are still some groups of people too small or too mobile or too primitive to warrant any response but the swing of the sword or the loosing of an arrow.
A silly comparison with the flags of the barbarian animals in Civ 4 versus the barbarians in Civ 4 also had the same flag, but also how it builds up the greatness of civilization itself versus what you actually do in gameplay.
This idea that there are some peoples or social constructs below consideration as equals, or worse, the idea that some people are just quote-unquote savages and capable of anything other than conquest and destruction, doesn't really gel with the rest of the game's self-image as a celebration of all of mankind's shared history. You know, where we've been and where we're going and all that feel-good jazz the game insists it's about.
It's an interesting watch, and certainly I would agree that what you see on the box art of a Civ game is really not 100% what you necessarily do in a typical game, sure. But I'm not sure if marketing the game as nuke your enemies into winning a UN victory is really what you want to put on the box anyway, especially if you want to sell this to some of your demographic that might be off-put by that kind of thing. So, I don't know. I don't know that you could do without an Errant Signal to some degree in the Civ franchise, but certainly there are valid points.
Since joining YouTube in April 2006 has more than 50,000 subscribers and in excess of 2.5 million video views, Bon Candy says, I think it's important to highlight that there's a stark contrast between what the game touts itself to be, a celebration of man's achievements, and what the game really projects itself to be, a series of events which serves as a means to a win state.
Yeah.
It trivializes history, and although it's an unavoidable side effect of the game mechanics, it's still present. And I'm thinking, I don't think the game is touting itself to be something that it is not. I think that's people's inference.
I wouldn't go that far, but you do get misled to some degree if you just, like, look at it versus playing it.
There, yes. That I could see, not actually playing it, not putting into context what it is being marketed as, because after all, it is a game.
Yeah.
Games need mechanics, and mechanics need to abstract some things, even though, I mean, at one point in time in game development, right, it was because, well, it's not sophisticated enough to do anything more than it's already doing, whereas I think now it's more about, is it fun?
Yeah.
And a lot of that fun is it fun to play? Would you rather be playing this game than something else or doing something that's quote-unquote real?
Yeah.
Some game mechanics are real, but some of the history that you could do with Civilization, you could make a simulation of the history that has already passed. You could make a different change than the history that already has passed, but it's only a simulation, since real history has already passed.
Civilization posits that the state is all that is or ever was. The humans themselves are incidental. And in that, I think, we start to see the key problem I have with the game as an adult. It frames the entire history of mankind as a history of nations, not as the history of people. For example, before you even have wheels, calendars, or written language, your people have decided that they are, in fact, a unified people. Which, I mean, that's kind of a new concept, historically speaking.
It's about reimagining history and making different choices. And I think if you really want something that's more mimicking of history within civilization itself, then there are a number of historical scenarios that give you that option that essentially recreate, you know, as much as you can approximate. This is what it was like, really. Now make a decision based on the mechanics for that particular scenario, but they didn't put that in the general game because, as Phil was getting out of the introduction, they're trying to take into account the potential market here, and given the amount of time and money that's put into the game, they want to make this as accessible to people as possible. And often when you want to make it accessible to more people, then you have to take some liberties and abstractions to make it less complicated and easier to pick up and go.
Yeah. That's true.
I think a lot of people in response to this video think that Errant Signal is ripping Civilization a new one.
I want to emphasize that I'm not hating on the game. I'm just trying to get to the core of what its mechanics and metaphor really add up to and what they say about the civilizations we live in. And what it presents, at least to me, is a peek into the mind of the state as an entity. And that view suggests that state governments are inherently dehumanizing and indifferent to suffering unless it harms them directly, narcissistic, almost to the point of solipsism, and motivated by base desires like survival, expansion, and power. And that's curious to me because civilization always builds itself as celebratory, a proud look back at all the things the collective we have accomplished across 50,000 years.
It's like, oh, social justice warrior comments on the Civilization series. Enjoy and or facepalm, said one user. I don't think it's an and or. I think it's enjoy and facepalm. And some of those facepalm moments are good because it gets you to stop and think critically about, if I'm playing Civilization and I'm enjoying Civilization, what does that say about me to other people? And if I'm thinking that way, are other Civilization players thinking that way? And if we start thinking about that and we think about the gameplay experience, then we can have an impact on how future titles in the series will look.
Civilization presents us all as being in a mad dash to be the first to be the bestest nation ever in one of a few areas. It suggests that if there is a human emotion experienced by these primal state entities that we play, it's pride. That the only time these nations look above their current need for more power is to build up and reinforce their legacy. You don't build the most culturally important city or the first trip to Alpha Centauri for the reasons that humans would do those things. You do them because it legitimizes your civilization in the eyes of other civilizations.
You know, when people first started talking about that, I realized that I am not a normal person in this regard. Like, a lot of people don't like doing evil acts in these games, and don't like it when they're abstracting doing evil acts. For example, the culture conversion in EU4, nuking somebody in Civ4, whereas, like, to me, I don't have any moral boundaries here when it comes to the game. Like, it's fun to do evil stuff in games. You can't do that otherwise, and nor would you want to. slavery in real life are horrifying, but in the game, you get to be, like, some evil overlord person if you want to be. And that can be fun. So, like, it didn't even occur to me that you would actually treat the game in any capacity like you would treat real life and be bothered by the concepts of doing extreme evils. I just assumed that they were extreme evils and we're done with it. But the concept of doing that stuff, if you try to put your real self into the game as the one making that decision, could probably bother you. But I guess not everyone looks at it that way.
Nukemal.
People have different frames of mind when they're playing these games.
Further in response, I like Mr. Rudy Mentory. Capital on the R, capital on the M. I hate the idea of fans refusing to think critically or accept criticism about something they like. The way I see it, you have to have strong emotions for a game or other piece of media in order to think so critically about something. If someone didn't give a damn about Civ, they wouldn't make a video complaining about it. Even if the person thinks negatively about the thing they're criticizing, they still care, even if it's due to them having loved the original concept or the series. When you think about emotions, you're most likely going to hear from somebody if they are ticked off because they want to see something changed for whatever reason. But if they're happy with it, most people are like, oh, okay, that's cool. I like. Maybe they'll click the like button, but they won't make a comment and they won't send an email or send a voicemail or create a whole separate video where they're criticizing something. And as long as it's not criticism for criticism's sake, that there's something constructive in it. I mean, I don't agree with everything that Aaron Signal is trying to say here, but I think it's worthwhile to address because he's trying to get us to think not only about how some other Civilization players think about the series, but also perhaps why when you start talking about Civilization, other people that you know online or in person roll their eyes in the back of their head or slowly back away from you.
The universality and finality of the Wind States reinforces a sort of fatalist one Civ to rule them all philosophy. It presents history as a sort of Hunger Games for countries. Only one gets to take the prize as the most important civilization ever. Which, again, makes sense given the game's board and strategy game roots, but reframes every decision in history as a zero-sum game leading up to a single nation achieving some sort of insurmountable achievement that proves their inherent superiority. And first of all, proving the inherent superiority of specific nations is really troubling for a lot of obvious reasons, but it also pits civilizations in direct competition in a way they aren't, really.
There was one, however, comment that whether you had a positive reaction to this video, a negative reaction, or a middle-of-the-road reaction, because there were definitely some of those. I was going through the comments, of which there were more than 700 when I had checked this video the day before the recording. Hairless Sasquatch, that's the username. I did not pick it for them. I'm not making this up. How lonely do you have to be to think of stuff like this? Well, talk about uniting against the troll. Free as a Car says, it's more a matter of curiosity, and almost ironically, you could say the same thing of the many great works of mankind that are featured in Civ. How lonely do you have to be to achieve greatness? That's not a response that I would give. I thought that's taking Hairless too seriously. Seth Weber says, yeah, fuck critical thinking. Why do people even waste their time trying to expand their mind and knowledge? It's so stupid. My response is, how bored do you have to be to care whether or not other people care about this? It just comes across to me as someone who is not interested in playing Civ. Well, I could be wrong about that, but I don't think it's how lonely do you have to be to think about stuff like this. I think it's maybe how involved in Civilization do you have to be to think about stuff like this? And I would say pretty involved, that you have a connection to the game. You feel strongly enough about it that you're getting enough out of the experience to continue playing it, and at the same time, you see how it should be improved, or it could be improved, and you want to express that in a way that gets other people to say, yeah, that's exactly what I'm thinking. Let's start talking about it, and maybe we can come up with a suggestion on how to improve it, at least improve from our perspective. I mean, you could take or leave what he said. I thought what he said was well said. I don't agree with everything, but I don't have to agree with everything he's saying to give it credit.
Civilization's roots and influences are in games where states fight states. Microprose and Fraxis just take that pattern and extrapolate it backwards onto all of history, whether it makes sense or not. This is why you have a centralized government with a single treasury, a research agenda, major public works projects, and all cities working towards a common goal, often before you've discovered writing. No part of civilization exists for its own sake. Everything exists as a means of harming, manipulating, or defending yourself from the other civilizations. That's elegant and beautiful from the perspective of designing a board-like computer game that plays really well, but it utterly dehumanizes the country you're playing as.
There was actually a related video that he published last October, Aaron Signal, which was Keep Your Politics Out of My Video Games.
Good luck with that.
Yeah.
There's certainly something to be said about the assumptions, say, civilization builds into its simulations. Look at its win states and what they value. Technological progress, military conquest, economic superiority, and cultural domination. You don't win by eliminating hunger, or poverty, or by nuclear deproliferation, or by having a particularly high standard of living. You get it for lack of a better way to phrase this, very American goals. Winning the space race? Becoming a recognized world leader at the UN? Having a giant, shiny army that can easily crush other civs? Cultural domination by so-called great works that get exported to the world? Civilization values what the culture that created it values, and while the game doesn't set out to be a political statement, the way it systemized the world certainly presents one.
Now, that video's got over 85,000 views, and it's got a ratio of about 6 likes to every dislike, whereas this video on Civilization, with about 27,000 views last I checked, had a ratio of 5 likes to every dislike.
Civilization isn't a game about cultural, financial, and military imperialism. It's just telling the story of man throughout time, as it's always been.
And then, with a couple of screenshots, he goes, Conquest is rewarded with cities. Woo! And puppet governments, forced annexation, and the raising of cities. No imperialism here. But I think that's just it. He said it right in the start. Civilization is a game.
Well, yeah.
I think a game like Civ, it deserves to be spoken of critically, for better and worse, but that's just the thing. It is a game. So at some point, you need to keep either your outrage over the response to the video or even your fanboyism in perspective.
Number 6 from episode 207. How the Civ community should regard giving away tiles during multiplayer matches.
There is a cheat, a human player cheat, give it away. And Clockwork Orange on the 2K forums says that this annoying cheat happened the past few games I've played multiplayer. And basically, whenever a human player is about to lose a city to another human player, and occasionally to the AI, he she gives the city away, often to the weakest player in the game. It's real annoying because it ruins momentum and often blocks a path to their other cities. Then, if you still want to take it, you have to declare war on the other civ, which runs up the warmonger penalty. Is this a cheat? Is there a way to fix this? And my personal opinion is summed up by the next comment by Pixel Ripper. It's not so much a cheat, it's a tactic. Then it comes down to really, do you find your game, not Civ in general, but the game that you're playing at that moment, are you playing it as a I'm here to win tactical and I'm using all the rules to my advantage? Or are you thinking, well, this is realism, I want to role play a relationship with other AI countries? And that's what it comes down to. I mean, I've done it before. I'm guilty of this, playing against the AI and saying, oh, look, this is just annoying. If I give that there, they have a problem. It's a tactic. But in real life, it would never happen. It's not a way to simulate real warfare. But then again, This is not Crusader Kings 2.
Or EU4. Yeah. Those are simulations.
They have their own problems. Yeah. But One thing they do that Civ probably should do here, I can't believe I'm saying this because usually it's the other way around, they don't let you sell crap while you're fighting in a war.
Yeah.
If you have enemy units in your city borders, you probably shouldn't be able to sell that city. Maybe you shouldn't be able to sell cities at war at all, but at least if you have enemy units in your borders, you should not be able to sell that city.
Or even just give it away. Not even sell it. Just say, here, take, please.
It's not cheating by definition. It's definitely not cheating, but it's a questionable game mechanic.
And people say it's more poor sportsmanship and spoil sport more than anything else. It's basically in a multiplayer setting, if you're trying to be competitive, it's the screw you, I'm not going to let you get what you actually earned from me.
Yeah.
So, meh.
Yeah, but aren't there so many other things as well in a Civ game that we could call poor sportsmanship, but the rules allow, and yet it happens?
I think that what it now comes down to, even if it's not quote-unquote fixed in the game, like Phil is addressing, then people who are going to be doing this in MP, word of mouth is a very powerful thing, even in the days of our technology, and people are going to soon know who these individuals are. Certain you could be like, oh, well, I'm in Steam, I'll just go ahead and change my name, blah, 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 blah. Well, besides the fact that there's a history record of names, or you could go to some extreme measures to create multiple accounts, blah, 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 blah. But pretty soon, you're going to be a pretty lonely person trying to play MP, if this is something you're doing, because most people aren't going to put up with it, because like has been said, it's a tactic, and it's cheap, and it's poor sportsmanship, and people who are really competitive, and even people who are not so competitive, aren't going to put up with poor sportsmanship. We even see this in co-op-ish moments that are turncast, where we're competing against the AI, and someone, I'm not going to be mentioning any names, even recently realized, I've captured this city from this particular civilization, I don't want it, none of the human players want it, so they go ahead and give it to an AI that somebody else is fighting. All part and parcel with whether they're giving the city away to another human player. If you have AI in the game as well, then you could go ahead and do that. And quite frankly, you could do that in a single-player game. Oh, geez, Civilization X is going to take this city. I'll just give it to Civilization Y. We just don't talk about it as much because most people don't know those things happen.
There's other issues, too. Now, granted, he also talks about warmonger penalties, and those really don't matter unless you're using AI. If it's all humans in the game, yeah, there's no warmonger penalty, really.
Yeah, there's indeed two issues being brought up by Clockwork Orange at the same time, multiplayer and warmonger penalty, and those don't match. Warmonger penalty is not important in multiplayer. Yeah, you might have one or two AIs straggling on the side or something, but in a multiplayer game, really, who cares about warmonger penalty?
It's probably all warmongering anyway, so it's all out in the wash.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's what most MP is, warmongering.
And AIs will get wiped out soon enough anyway, so who cares?
If you even have them.
Yeah. Depends on how you've set things up, but if it's a competitive multiplayer game where humans are fighting humans and you're doing PvP, yeah, the AI doesn't matter.
Probably shouldn't put in AI because it's a substantial advantage to whoever happens to spawn your AI and not a human because they don't have to be honest.
Yeah. Otherwise, I would just say, tell people if you're hosting the game, tell them you may not sell cities to other people while at war, as a house rule sort of thing, and anybody breaks it, well, kick them out of the game.
Yep, that's a good idea, setting up a set of house rules. But you could also say, in this game, here are my house rules. By the way, give it away is allowed in this game, and see how people start changing their player tactics. You could say, in this game, one of the house rules is, it's a legit tactic. You might see some players say, hey, I want to go in for that because I really want to play a Civ game, trying to take advantage as much as I can about the rules built into the game by the programmers.
That's fine, too. As long as you have rules agreed upon ahead of time, then you can do anything, really.
And the longest rules are enforced as well.
Yeah.
If you're the host of a game and you say there's none of this, and someone does it, in addition to calling them out, kick them out.
Yeah.
Make it a core rule that this is just not going to be permitted, and send them the message that way. If they have to learn the hard way, then so be it. And you might think, well, what if the host does it?
Well, then everybody else can leave.
Exactly. Send the message that way. That's no problem.
Instead of kicking him out, punishment being in-game, as in everyone gangs up on that one guy.
Nah.
Yeah.
Kicking him out basically means that they turn into an AI. Because if you actually leave it to, okay, everybody gang up on this guy, you might have people who agree to fight, but then don't actually do anything.
That, and I like the fact that if it's an in-house rule, then you're outside of the gameplay mechanics for the rule, so use an outside of gameplay mechanics for enforcing, which is Das Boot.
Hmm. Yeah.
Dan's favorite boat.
Now, someone might say, but Polycast, what if someone says that the in-house rule is allowed and you don't like it? Well, I guess it depends. How much don't you like it? You can leave. You can try to convince a change before you leave, I suppose. But if in the end, on balance, you don't like it, then yeah, just leave. I'm certain there'll be someone else willing to take your place, or they'll just go ahead with one less player. That's fine.
I think usually if someone would see this as legitimate in an in-house rule before jumping into the game, they're going to realize this tactic is going to be used left, right, and center. That's why it has been legitimized for this game.
Yeah. Unless the dev are going to come along and switch it to what Phil suggested as in, if at war, can't sell cities. Of course, that also assumes that they might even consider another patch, but...
I wonder if this problem's going to pop up in the CBE.
Number 10, from episode 199.
See if you can figure out what Unity's talking about based on the description. First, it seems I can never build them because of the endemic coal shortage in my games. Second, when I plan for a seafaring domination strategy, they are quite hard to deal with even with frigates. And even if you manage to capture it, refer to point one. They also seem beast versus cities at this era.
Dun, 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 dun.
And you would never say this about the Unit Civ 4, but... Begins with an I.
Start with an I?
It starts with an I and ends with a D. Hello, Ironclad. How are you?
Number 9. Also from episode 199.
How do you actually get in the melee unit in? Good luck with that.
What?
Get a melee unit in. Good luck with that.
Cataphract.
Shut up.
Well, this escalated quickly.
Yeah.
So you.
But Magic has said that you have the usual conversation ender.
Because?
No, not that one. Starts with your.
Imagine, can you just say it? Mackie's been deprived. You gotta watch the show. She's forgetting your voice. So you have to say this expression so she knows it's truly you and you are, in fact, not a dingo. The imposter wouldn't know this phrase, clearly. Authenticate.
Your mom.
Didn't sound too certain. Might be a dingo after all.
Number 8 from episode 190.
We are all drama monarchs here.
What the heck, Dan? Everybody knows the phrase is drama queen. You had to go for the gender neutral. Drama monarch.
Trying to be politically correct.
No, we're just going for the Civ theme. And, you know, you gotta get the monarch in there. It sounds more Civ-like.
Number 7 from episode 213.
The last time we were talking about a Civilization title release, excluding expansion packs, was in 2010, and, you know, probably before some of our listeners were born.
Oh, come
no,
on.
No, it's probably a bit extreme yet. You know, we like to get them started young on Polycast, because that ensures that they will continue to listen to the show. Mackie behaves that they will continue to listen to the show well into their... I don't want to speculate on how long they're going to live. That sounds kind of odd. Into their later years... Later years, yeah, that's...
Dan's going off on so far a tangent that he's teleported himself.
It is the skill, Maggie, you would know.
Number 6 from episode 207.
Yeah.
Wait a minute, before we actually get to the first topic. have you seen the chat today? The Ustream chat?
I saw somebody said they would get here early while I was sleeping, but ha-ha, the joke's on you, it's already awake.
Okay, so you've seen it. Please, please read exactly what the Star of Hope had to say about you. Clarice.
She said, I thought I'd come early while the Mackie was sleeping. She's scary when she's awake.
Nice. This might kill you for your cup of coffee. And then what else?
You know, like, she might kill you for your cup of coffee. No, I know how to acquire my own cup of coffee, thank you.
Just have to kill you for it, but she might.
If you get between me and the cup of coffee, we might have to have a problem.
Number 5 from episode 197. Playstyle instead of player choice is tested in the context of Civ 5 ideology selection.
We're not the only people that have ideas for the game. Pixel Ripper on the 2K forums poses the question, what if instead of choosing your ideology chose you? What if your actions during the game ultimately defined your ideology instead of just picking the one you want? Perhaps it could be influenced by the first 3 policies that you chose, the order you chose them, how many times you've declared war, declared friendship, your research agreements, etc. And Pixel Ripper asks, would this wild card add flavor to the game or not? What other actions might dictate your civilization's ideology? Research focus, espionage actions, etc.
It would add flavor to the game, and that flavor would be not so palatable.
You'd have to give yourself a score for each of those actions, and the game would be tracking it. And what people would do is manipulate the score so they didn't hit certain thresholds.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, but ultimately doing that would lower your strategic choice to some degree, because you would consistently do the same thing to pick your desired ideology. So your initial game actions would actually be more on rails than they are currently, where you can do a hard switch. And sometimes you want to do a hard switch for one reason or another, and having that option denied to the player actually reduces the total amount of choices you can make across the playthrough.
Yeah, or it'll go the opposite way. Instead of tailoring what you do in the early game so that you get the ideology you want, maybe you'll just end up with the same ideology every time, because that's how you play the early game. Like, I think everybody who is not being aggressive would just end up with freedom. The victory condition that order locks out is diplomatic victory. Everyone has a couple city-states by the time they get an ideology, whereas the AI, half of them won't have any city-states. And freedom, the soft lock of the victory condition that you're not supposed to go for, is military. So if you're playing a nice peaceful game, you really may have the lowest military when you get an ideology. So almost always, I would think the computer would just assign you freedom. And that's not always fun.
And it would reduce our flexibility, too, because sometimes the game's going one way, and then that AI shows up on your shore with an army, and you're like, well, time to go be a warmonger.
Not to mention the effect that it would have on the AI.
theme in the responses was that taking away choices from the player is kind of not in keeping with the spirit of Civilization. It's all about having lots and lots of choices, an overwhelming amount of choices in some cases, but just being handed, oh, by the way, now you're a communist, it doesn't feel like Civilization to me.
And I think in a way we kind of have this in the sense of if you go down a particular ideological path and there's another civilization that's exerting its ideological influence on you and their ideology is different than yours, then you will now find yourself in a situation where you have dissidence, if not outright revolt. That comes after an extended period of time of ignorance or neglect on your part and not responding to that, either by switching to that ideology or buffing your defense, your culture, and or increasing your tourism, your offensive culture output towards ideology to push back on that. So it goes back to choices.
Going back to the losing to Science City, about the last game I played, I actually lost my largest Science City. This was towards endgame, but it flipped. And I thought I'd never had a city flip on me before to another ideology because I managed happiness well. But I was halfway dominating the world. I didn't care at this point. So I said, okay, I'll stay at like negative 20 on happiness. I can still take over cities. And for whatever reason, not even anywhere close to any other AI, my main Science City in this game flipped over to the second most powerful, which is actually Greece, coincidentally, the second most powerful civilization. And I was absolutely, like, devastated, and that probably extended the game by some 50 turns.
Pax in this thread on 2K says that Galactic Civilization 2 did or does this, you know, where quote-unquote ideology chooses you. Events will pop up from time to time, and you choose one of three possible reactions to them. One good, one neutral, one evil. The rewards differ for each choice, and they move you in the direction of that alignment with each event, too. Okay, that might work with Galactic Civilizations 2, for example, because it also makes me think of Alpha Centauri, where your civilization is more like a faction. The faction or civilization that you've chosen already has a little bit of a backstory. It's not quite so much as open-ended as you would have, say, in Civilization. And quite frankly, the possible reactions to them, one good, one neutral, one evil, even if we can all agree on what a good, neutral, or evil action is, I would say a better way to look at it would be whether it's an event or anything, whether it's a good, not as opposed to good versus evil, like bad versus evil, but good as in your strategy. Is this a good choice at that particular point in time, knowing what it is that you know for your civilization, for what it is that you want to do? I don't think that kind of focus would work well in Civilization.
That reminds me of features from old Civs that we didn't mention in our suggest features for Civ 5. Random events! Who wants to see those back? Yeah?
Don't go on yet.
Exactly.
A slave revolt has taken place in your capital.
Similar points. Shushu62, who was a regular co-host for a time on the now-defunct CivCast, which focused on Civilization World, Master of Orion worked down that path. If you recall, you could not pick your text, just your areas of focus. And of course, as an aside, this goes to Pexel Ripper's point of, you know, what other actions might dictate, you know, your civilization's ideology, like research focus, for example. Back to Shushu, those personality choices in Galciv 2 are the best part of the game. Master of Orion 3, however, points out the potential downfall. If the computer scripts too much of what you can do, you lose sight of cause and effect. Quote unquote. Well, you don't lose sight of cause and effect. Your cause is the game's programming screwed you over, and the effect is you probably rage quit. Shushu then says Alpha Centauri gave you the choice to play with deterministic and non-deterministic text paths. Played 75% non-determined and 25% determined.
Alpha Centauri also had an option to not choose your text, but instead areas of focus, and you would randomly get texts. They were weighted for, like, scientific advancement, ecology, stuff like that, and you would get ones depending on your area of focus.
That's actually not a bad thing. You would take a different path through the tech tree, at least, but then Alpha Centauri's tech tree was a little more spread, where Civ is pretty narrow, I guess is the best way I can put that. I mean, like, when you, especially when you're in the early tech tree, how do you define what you're concentrating? I could see a war versus peacetime division, but then what's in the middle? I mean, because you really would need a third category somehow. I don't know. Maybe science, economic, and military focuses?
And so then it would work similarly then like in Alpha Centauri, where it would give you a quote-unquote random technology based on that focus, given where you are in the game. Like, would there be any other way to wait? Like, if you chose economy, for example, would there be any other kind of variables to try to steer it towards some particular economic technologies or others or priorities of, or?
I know there was a way somebody figured out how to do that with that in Alpha Centauri, but it was a pain in the butt to keep track of, you know?
To memorize the weighting for every tech. Like, you might know that pottery had 4 points of weighting for economics and archery had 2 points of weighting for military, and you could steer where you were going by picking those focus. But, I mean, if you want to control which tech you researched, there was a checkbox at the beginning of the game for that. Why didn't you just do that?
I guess I could see it working for a civilization application so long as there wasn't, you know, for example, some of the bottleneck issues we have right now with Civ 5, that you must kind of get this first before you're then able to get the next thing. So that kind of focus might allow you to kind of go around that. And so long as it's deterministic of where you're able to memorize the weighting, so long as it wasn't, well, you want to memorize the weighting of this tech because of what it gives you is almost always going to be what it is that you want to do in the first place, if you know what I mean.
Well, theoretically, you could memorize the weighting for Pixel Ripper's ideology chooses you thing, but I don't find either idea very attractive. I play this game because I'm a control freak, so I want to control every aspect of my civilization. I don't want to hear that they've researched horseback riding when I wanted them to research something else. Or congratulations, you are now an autocratic nation state.
I agree with that. When you lose control, there's less ability to roleplay. What if I didn't want Gandhi to become autocratic, even though I was taking over half the world? I think I should be a democracy.
Bringing freedom to the poor, unenlightened masses.
Yes.
Riding on the back of a nuclear missile.
Well, those words are backed by nuclear weapons.
It is true that if you were to choose something like this, there is that balance between, quote-unquote, having a choice and not having a choice. Because in the sense that something could happen in the game, and then you end up saying, well, I don't have a choice, I have to do this. Well, you don't necessarily have to do that, but if you don't do that, then you're almost certainly going to be hurting yourself. Kind of like into a gameplay versus realism thing, in the sense that I want to feel like that I have control, but at the same time, I don't want it to be that I can control it so strongly that I can just rinse and repeat for good or bad every single time. I think what we're getting here is a matter of degrees, and that's not so easy to define.
Yeah, I mean, like, you always research pottery first, right? So that's not really a choice, because that's always the right move. I mean, you could click on something else.
Yeah, I do animal husbandry sometimes.
Brave New World, I'm choosing pottery. I mean, it's actually first and foremost not for what you would think inherently, which is, oh, you mean, you know, for the growth through the granary. I actually know it so I can...
Faith.
Yeah, so I can do the shrine. But it's the fact that it's, hey, it's both of those things combined. Woohoo!
Too much loaded on that one tech.
Yeah, I've always been in favor of moving shrine to just be available from the very beginning.
Yes, because before we knew how to make clay things, we totally didn't have shrines and other things anyway.
No pottery, no faith.
Because we totally can't make stick figure and twig representations of our gods and hunting animals and all that. And
but once you have pottery, you can build cottage now.
So important.
Number 4 from episode 214. When criticisms on the show are cited as not being constructive, a response is generated.
Hi, this is Tim, also known as Mazeppa PZ, and just wanted to give a comment. I love Civ, love podcasts, and love Moments of the Polycast podcast. The recent discussion in 211, taking stock of the Arabian civilization in Brave New World, is the type of comment I love. Experts providing insight into the strengths, weaknesses, and strategies of different aspects of Civ. What I don't enjoy, however, are pedantic criticisms of the game itself and discussions of whether or not different things are OP. This might be compelling if I were actually employed by Firaxis, and I do appreciate that some of you actually do have the ear of game designers. That's great, but for me, critiques of the game, breaking down what is OP, unbalanced, and what might be better designed, is kind of like listening to an abstruse splitting of hairs about the rules of football or some other sport, as opposed to the fun of actually watching a game. So with the upcoming release of Beyond Earth, we have the opportunity for a fresh slate, a chance for discussions about exciting aspects of the game, which is going to be new for all of us. So imagine my disappointment on number 611 hearing a snippy argument about over whether a base station's granting of a new technology is OP. The game's not even out, and we're already bogged down and barking up the same old trees. So please help me to learn how to discover new ways to enjoy our games. Thanks. Tim from North America, MAZEPPAPZ. Thanks.
So we received this voicemail back in October and before Beyond Earth was released, seeing as how he mentioned that the game wasn't even out yet. My response to his email, hi, Tim. On Polycast, we work to balance coverage of the Civilization series. This includes not only strategy for what is in a game, but also the circumstances that led to the strategy coming about in the first place. Your sports analogy is apt. We believe it is important to question the nature as well as the content of the rules for the influence even determine play on the field. The BE station topic is one that generated much discussion within the Civ community, which was a primary reason why we covered it on the show. We worked to present all recognizable sides on the issue, ultimately concluding that determining if something is overpowered or not must follow the game's release in order to be realized. For a significant portion of our audience, including ourselves, our enjoyment out of Civ comes about from a number of efforts, including raising concerns in a constructive fashion that itself is intended to generate discussion, reflection, and feedback. And I'll add here, we got feedback from you on this, as a matter of fact. So this includes for developer Firaxis Games and its publisher 2K Games as an expression of, you know, shared ownership and how games in the series are regarded and shaped. Now, at the same time, our enjoyment also comes from challenging ourselves and each other to improve our gameplay as the games are. That all said, I do believe our position and yours can continue to coexist. Our show notes are detailed and specific with timestamps, which means that when you come across a topic that you do not find to your liking, you can move past it and onto one that is. I hope that we can continue to count on you as part of the Polycast audience. Tim said that I am honored to receive such a thoughtful response. I wouldn't have written to complain if I didn't have such admiration for you and your other panelists' obvious expertise. He concluded with, I'll leave you with one more thought. When you complete an episode, quickly review the content in your mind and decide if, on balance, it would sound to a first-time listener as if you all liked the game and were enthusiastic about it, or rather, the number of criticisms would convey an overall sense of disappointment in the series. The stronger the score, this is in quotation marks, in the first category, I'm guessing, the more enjoyable that episode will be for listeners. I don't know about my fellow panelists here, but I think that discussing criticisms shows that we have an interest in the series. Yes, we have an opinion, and perhaps you hear some more negative criticisms just because there's a stronger emotion involved, but I think it comes about if we are criticizing and we're being constructive about it, if we just kind of said what the criticism was and then just blasted the game, you know, insert some explicatives here, and then moved on, then maybe our rage is kind of final, but our hope in constructively criticizing is that even if things are not changed in the immediate future or ever, at least we feel we had the opportunity to engage with Firaxis, engage with 2K, and engage the audience to let people know that if you're a Civ player and you're feeling that this is not working, you're not the only one.
Yeah, first and foremost, a lot of it comes from the community. So when the community itself is having a major 20-page discussion over on CFC about whether or not this thing's OP, it kind of follows that we might want to pick up on that because it's something that not just us are having some discussions about. On the specific note, I will point out that the game did not launch with the station giving the free tech, so it's not like Firaxis doesn't listen, though I doubt it was to us because, you know, who listens to the show?
No, wait a minute. There's a difference between giving credit to the show and giving credit to the outcry. It's possible that it got fixed because of the outcry, not because that we also mentioned it on the show, but it certainly didn't hurt.
Yeah, yeah.
Or maybe it did. I don't
know.
Who knows?
So part of it could be also that we're bringing up to a larger audience because not everybody goes to CFC that watches the show. So those two groups might not overlap. On top of that, there's a bit of question on credibility gap, because if the only thing we focus on is the nice and cool stuff, the stuff we like, then we, especially myself and the main team who do other sort of things, start looking a lot less credible in the eyes of our viewers. Because if the only thing we say is nice stuff about things that we're doing, then I know personally I'd have a lot less viewers. If all they hear is a mouthpiece for Firaxis or 2K, then we might as well not exist. And at least that's my opinion on that. So on the balance, we do need to talk about other stuff. As for the whole question of rules versus gameplay, Civ as a series is about strategy, is about the rules. Playing Civ is just as much about the rules of Civ as it is about the gameplay of Civ. There are lots of people, I know I don't tend to do a huge amount of playing with the rules, but the main team and a lot of people on the forums who will go down to the map and do all the little tiny detail calculations to find out what's better than this and that, that's all about the rules. And that tells you what is good gameplay according to the rules and what is not. And there are a lot of people who compete, and especially in multiplayer, if one person knows that this set of rules when put together is broken, they're going to win a lot more than somebody else who might just not really understand it as much. So for us, for this particular genre and this particular game, it really does matter. It'd be kind of like, if we want to go back to football, that somewhere along the way, there's this little rule set that says that you can just hand off a free ball onto the field if you drop it. You know, stuff like that kind of matters. Rules matter. For our show, it's not just the what cool features are in there or what people are talking about, but it's also the game itself. We need to have that discussion because it does come up in our community. And if our community is talking about all of these things and we're not, then we're not really doing a podcast for our community.
I think the important part with those kind of discussion is that it must be constructive criticism. Like in the example of the station at the Blue, it was changed. There was a problem with it. And so discussing it was actually useful. It wasn't just complaining for the sake of complaining.
Yeah, we do a lot of that too, but...
Yes, yeah. Sure.
Sometimes we just have a thing, we just have to complain about it, but we are trying to be constructively criticizing them. It's just sometimes we pull our discussions from the community, therefore it's something that the community has already noticed and said, hey guys, we think there's a problem. So we discuss it. We may not agree, you know, even within ourselves or even in total with the community stuff, but we know that the Phyrexians listen to the podcast and it puts these issues into their head that, you know, maybe we need to look at that. We're trying to help make the game better because we like the game, not because we want to sit here and go, oh, it sucks, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, Phyrexians listen, and they're even on the show from time to time as well to engage with us and to engage with the audience. And Mackie makes also an interesting point and a good point about we don't always agree on the show on particular issues. We usually agree that this is an issue and we should discuss it, but we don't always agree on what our opinion should be. And it is true that when we raise community issues, there are times that we will, shall I phrase this, sanitize. Or sometimes we will take what is anything but a constructive criticism and try to find that diamond in the rough and turn it into something constructive. So we cut out the BS, we cut out the noise, and then we try to give voice to, again, all sides of the issue. I'm not going to say both sides of the issue because so often there is more than two sides. And, of course, one of the options is always just mod it. But short of that...
Dan likes to polish turds.
As Matt said, I think it's also Phil and Matt represent themselves, but they also represent Polycast. So if they go and they say something on a forum, or Mackie and I do the same thing, if all we were doing was looking at the bright side and not looking at the dark or the darker side.
Yeah, people need sunshine blown up there, you know what. I mean, there are places to get that.
Oh, easily.
Welcome to the internet, and perhaps even literally, I don't know.
You know what I mean, though. If you want the kissy-kissy, oh, the game is great and spectacular, la, 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 there's places to do that. We're trying to be somewhere in the middle. We like the game. There's things we love about the game, but there's also problems. No game is perfect, not even Civ, Dan.
Yeah. This is also a strategy podcast. I mean, it's normal that we are discussing the kind of the intricacies of the game. We are the people who enjoy the game by playing it a lot. Some would say maybe too much. And so we analyze every little thing about it. That's also, this podcast is supposed to talk about those things, even negative things.
Yeah.
Yeah, if there's an exploit thing that you can overabuse, we should talk about that. We're not trying to pick on every bad thing about the game, but those are the things that are going to come up more quickly than the more little intricate strategy things, which, I mean, Beyond Earth's only been out a few weeks, so not everyone's been able to dig into it and see all the little things. So right now, of course, we're going to concentrate on the obvious problems, like stations spawning right where you want to put the city. Dang it. But it's things that will disappear. You know, if you listen to us when Civ 5 first came out, I'm sure we had similar things. It probably sounded like we didn't like the game, but we did like the game. There's just a few things that needed to tweak, and then it would be great. That's all we're trying to do.
As people go on, build out strategies, and that's sort of the stuff that we want to talk about, because some of the strategies are built on game rules. Mm-hmm. So it's important.
Number 3 from episode 191, While no production is generated from jungle wood clearing, is the question still being asked?
Started by Kaiko, the thread is titled, "Why does chopping a jungle produce nothing?" And we all are already off to a wrong start, because I would assert that it clearly produces frustration. But that's not the point. The thread reads, "Hello all. So after yet another jungle start, I'm curious if anyone has any theories why chopping jungle provides nothing akin to chopping down forest, which takes less time to attack and takes less time for your worker to accomplish. It seems nonsensical to me. Even if jungle doesn't produce production from chopping, why not a food infusion or a tiny bit of culture? The current difference between forest and jungle chopping seems to me to be a relic of legacy game design choices that have long since been left in the dustbin. I disagree there, too. I feel like chopping jungle is one of those things that has carried over quite well between games."
Yeah.
What's left in the dustbin?
Like, ever since it existed, it has been unfavorable to start with the jungle. I'd say Civ 5 is actually a little less bad in that regard, and it's still iffy at best.
Jungle wood doesn't necessarily make for great lumber, as Jazzy Cat was trying to point out.
Yeah, that's commonly said in the thread, and it's a good point. From a historical standpoint, it's less favorable to start in the middle of a jungle, but I don't know, from a gameplay standpoint, I do question the way it's balanced currently. Because if you're not making the effort to use the wood in any capacity, why don't you just have like a burn jungle button or something?
I guess it would be more accurately described as clear jungle.
Well, sure. However you want to call it, but it's true that it does take pretty long, and I don't think that is necessarily 100% historically accurate compared to, say, its usefulness.
Compared to, say, taking a match and a lighter and just burning down that section?
Yeah.
Well, in a way, it's not so much about the chopping the jungle producing nothing. It's that by removing the jungle, you can actually do something, so to speak, that it actually clears the land. Although at the same time, because, now of course, yes, the Civilization V, that if you construct a university, and by if, I mean you almost probably should be. But anyway, once you construct, you're able, you know, get to education, construct a university, then each one of those jungle tiles starts producing science. You kind of have to make a choice that you can either leave the jungle alone and get that science later, or is it more worthwhile chopping that jungle? And then when it comes to science, well, just allow your city to grow even more so you can, once you get the university, you can start working scientist specialist spots, for example, and then you can just have the science from there.
Exactly. So in the thread, like, Abraxas and Cat 5-1 both bring up good points, and I think it has to do with balancing, because if you get later on game benefits from actually having those tiles available to you, or you can actually turn it into a plains tile and get those hammers, being able to actually receive hammers from chopping it as well sort of makes it a better tile than actually being surrounded by just traditional forest.
You know, if you should happen to rolled Brazil and you're chopping jungle, you're doing it wrong.
Yeah, don't chop your jungles.
In the thread, Aspen28570 says, "Why not just have it," and by that being chopping the jungle, "give you a small sum of gold when cleared instead of hammers? The gold bonus would not be that much, between 15 to 40 gold per hex."
That's a lot more than you think.
Well, in the end, it's not that much. About the same as production on that one, though. I mean, you could do that, because then you could say you're selling the jungle rare hardwoods, whatever, for money. Which is, you know, more plausible than getting hammers. But still, that jungle tile is still way better with jungle. Unless, of course, it's sitting on a luxury or a hill that you really want to turn into a mine. In which case, you're turning it into mine anyway, so...
And this is hardly the first time this topic has come up. In the sense that, I mean, B. Kaiko, who, by the way, was a guest on episode 145 in April of 2012, talked about, you know, relic of the legacy game design choices. Back in May of 2008, Magma Dragoon started a thread, "Jungle Chop should give hammers in the context of Civilization IV. So I think regardless of whatever civilization we're talking about, it is represented well. It's balanced well, both gameplay-wise and taking into realism considerations, too.
Yeah. Although there was points made somewhere in here like jungle science should be reduced to one, at least early game, which sort of makes more sense because the big science-y stuff didn't come till much later in the game.
Balance. Give them something.
Balance. Research labs. That should give you science from jungles.
Oh my gosh. Come on now.
Come on. It'll make them actually worthwhile.
I think there are different opinions on worthwhileness of that.
I don't think there are. I think there are different focuses on the reasons for saying things.
Oh, to me, jungle would stand to even have less of a chance of sticking around on the map if I had to wait till a research lab. I mean, I'm all for helping out, you know, certain late-game buildings, although I think the research lab is okay. It's the medical lab that's a bit more... But
extra food from jungle.
Well, sure, you can get extra food by having a citizen work a tile that gives you food and not the jungle.
Yeah. Well, you can always trading post the jungle anyways and get science out of that from rationalism. And then you just wait a little longer before you get more.
Yeah, you could do that. That's late enough so as not to be, whoa, we're going kind of in the other extreme here as opposed to, but the game's over, man.
Yeah, but B. Kaiko's comment about jungles being unbalanced compared to forests, I think is completely and utterly wrong. Page 2, he starts getting into gameplay-wise, it's pretty unbalanced. And I would say it's exactly unbalanced the opposite way. Jungles plus trading post, or Brazil wood camp, depending on what you do, is far more powerful than anything you can do with the forest. Anything.
Number 2, from episode 194. Comparing Civilization 5 to Alpha Centauri, element by element, to understand design choices.
Autoclave over on the Sifanatics one started a topic about comparing Civ 5 to my favorite thing, Alpha Centauri. So he had just recently played Alpha Centauri after having played Civ 5 for about 700 hours and gave him some fresh perspective on Civ 5, actually. First thing he was going, hexes versus squares. He really likes the hexes. You know, I think all of us at first, when Civ 5 first came out, we were like, hexes? But it's not working out too badly.
Hexes better. Done.
What are you, Gordon Ramsay with the done thing?
Done.
There's just not a lot to say that squares are better than hexes.
It was all about the diagonal movement with squares.
Yeah, it was, it was a cheating diagonal movement.
No, it's not cheating. It was in the game.
It's by design. You just move faster but going one direction. It wasn't, like, sensible, but it wasn't cheating.
It was there on purpose.
Then there's also good old-fashioned unit stacking, which, well, we don't have a unit stacking exactly anymore, although we can still stack bombers pretty well. Yeah. Now we just have carpet of doom instead of stack of doom. It takes a little more management, but you can still make a thing of doom.
Yeah, and in this case, autoclave was actually missing the stacking. Hexes versus squares, he gave that to Civ 5, like plus one for Civ 5, but here it's plus one to Alpha Centauri, because it really forces me to pay attention to where to place individual units.
I don't know, is that necessarily him saying that that's a bad thing?
No.
That could be viewed as saying it's a good thing also.
Really,
from a design standpoint, you pick one or the other, sure, but a game that uses either can be really good, so it's not like necessarily...
I don't know. I wouldn't say forcing me to pay attention is a bad thing. Unless, of course, he doesn't want to pay attention, and then it would be a bad thing, but...
Yeah, because on unit stacking, you just have this huge stack of units, and it just, the game decides which one it's going to attack, whereas now with our one unit of tile, we have to pay attention and, you know, like, put things in front to shield ranged units, keep the trebuchets and things towards the back. You have to pay at least some more attention to it other than get stack, aim at city.
Look, like in Civ games, score is really important in this thread, so I'm trying to give a point to Alpha Centauri, because a lot of it is, yay Civ 5, yay Civ 5, Civ 5 better, Civ 5 better, and I got kind of monotonous, so I decided to interpret this as giving plus one to Alpha Centauri.
Are you trying to give away the thread before Mackie gets to it?
No, I'm giving the quantity of the thread. Mackie is giving the quality.
Another big thing he noticed in was tall versus wide, because he was like, thank you, Firaxis, for making tall cities a really strong and viable tactic, which I believe referring to Civ 5, you can make that, because in Centauri, it's very easy to set up like this grid pattern of a bunch of little cities, because you could just go exponential with all of your growth and everything. In other words, you only thought you did ICS in other versions of Civ.
Well, I think Civ 2 was pretty similar in that regard, and Civ 3.
Yeah, Civ 3 was pretty hardcore ICS.
Basically, everything before maintenance in Civ 4, I don't know that there was a better strategy than ICS spam.
Yeah, the killer thing in Alpha Centauri, you have the satellites, which I don't know if there's actually a top end of the counter. Maybe it's 255, but you can launch these ones that will add plus one food or energy or production to every city. You could sit there and you could spam out satellites, and then every city has like plus 99 or something ridiculous.
Ridiculous.
What I really liked about Alpha Centauri was the way that you could build on the oceans and the waters. Just have a huge grid. No need to worry about any kind of coastal invasions. Just fill it with cities.
Yep, sorry, you're not going past this city. Oh, God, can you imagine if it had the Civ 5 type of cities where you'd be firing at them?
Boat drives past, gets blasted.
Yeah, your boat, that ain't going nowhere.
He talks about the tech tree in Civ 5 being better than the smack tech maze, but I'm not sure. The tech tree is one of the things I really dislike about Civ 5 because it's too linear.
We can get to internet without computers. Something's not right.
Nah, that's just a label. I'm just talking it's way too linear. Like, there's no crossovers from Civ 4 where this little tooltip says, you know, this part of the tech tree is attached to that part of the tech tree versus in Civ 5 where it's like, if you can't draw a direct line without crossing another line, it can't fit.
Yeah.
It was a mess.
Yeah, and Alpha Centauri had an interesting setting when you started the game where you could make it where you only got a certain selections of tech to pick from to research your next tech. It was semi-random in that case.
Hmm.
After you play the game X number of times and you catch yourself always going up this certain path, like everybody straight to composite bows, you know, here you try a different play style to think differently.
That's what I don't like about a lot of the tech trees and really even games outside of Civ. You wind up with false choice where going one direction is the right direction almost every time or every time to the point where you don't have to think about it. You just go there. That does hurt the experience a little bit. It really should be a hard choice, ideally.
Yeah, because in Civ 5, I keep finding myself, I go riding, go grab sailing if I'm on the coast, then go get composite boats to go smash who's ever on my island or continent. Maybe you take a slight diversion and grab something for a luxury resource you have, but that's the start every time.
Yeah, it does get boring. I don't mind the Mac tech tree. Maybe I'm forgetting it, but...
No,
I don't remember it in detail.
He couldn't figure out what to research for the next thing, but I'm pretty sure the game came with a printout thing that showed you that. Like,
what?
Yeah, it, well, 1999, did, guys, there were still physical media.
Once upon a time, there were manuals.
Yeah.
Now we have the internet.
There weren't PDF files.
You put this picture on your wall so you could see the tech tree in the game.
I had that. That was awesome. Yeah.
And after you play the game a few times, you start knowing, I got to go this way so I can go get plasma first. One thing we do not miss from the previous versions of Civ and from Alpha Centauri, embarkation, having to put the guys on the boats, transports.
What's a boat?
Well, okay, we still have to put bombers and fighters on a carrier, but that's nowhere near the micromanaging it took to move an army between continents.
I'm not sure that the previous system has actually had less clicks in total because of the stacking. If you used a good waypoint system in Civ 4, for example, you could have all of your units go to one city with all of your boats and then load them in the aggregate.
Yeah, the waypoint was fantastic in previous versions of Civ. As you say, just load them all on, get all the transports in the city, load them up, and then off they go.
Yeah, well, there's also the fact that this is actually, I think, a little bit easier for the AI to understand.
Oh, yeah, and if you go with a one-unit per tile model, you have no choice. You cannot do that kind of transport stuff. It'd just be a disaster.
Yeah.
Please build one transport to transfer one unit.
No.
And then protect that transport with other city units.
Yeah, see, now they come up, run into your fleet on your way over to them. At least they can only take a couple of units off of you instead of half your army in one transport. Trading for in-game currency in Civ 5. He likes the trade caravans and the cargo ships, which you have to stop and think, do you want to send it to these city-states? Do you want to send it over here and get some extra science? But then they also get science, and, you know.
I agree.
The old style was, it was really nice, but I think the caravan is and the cargo ships are a vast improvement.
You actually make decisions in Civ 5 regarding trade, like... Rather than, hey, I'm going to open borders with a sea route or a road to the AI and then get trade. And if I have a bunch of coastal cities, maybe I'll build the Great Lighthouse and my auto-win button if I get past a certain number of cities for doing so. Wow. The trade is a lot more dynamic.
Well, in fairness, he's really now comparing Civilization V, Brave New World, to Alpha Centauri.
Well, yes, that's true.
True, but you don't see any of us complaining about that addition to Brave New World.
Well, Alpha Centauri had its opportunities for expansion. I mean, the hardest thing in this comparison is just that Alpha Centauri is old. And so a lot of things that have happened in gaming from then to now give Civ 5 an advantage from a design standpoint. Stuff just couldn't be done back then in some regards, or hadn't been thought of yet, depending on CPU limitations or just the progression of gaming in general.
So yeah, there are going to be things that Civ 5 is going to be better in just because of that.
But not diplomacy.
Well, but not diplomacy.
Oh yeah, the Alpha Centauri. Here, let me kill everyone off except this one person who's my little bitch. Hey, I want to melt all the polar caps. Do you mind? No, I didn't think so. Because seriously, with the council on that, if you had a huge population, you dominate it. You've got a bunch of votes. You're very easy to vote yourself in. Well, some things were a yes or no and not based on your number of people, but still.
I found it interesting that Autoclave said that Alpha Centauri diplomacy is as good as Civ 5 diplomacy.
Yeah, I started laughing.
I don't think that's
really?
Wrong,
yeah, how old is the game? How far have we progressed? Just not in diplomacy.
Given that, I would actually give that as like a plus one to Alpha Centauri. Yeah,
if it's just as good and that old, then yeah, definitely.
The council was a good idea. You know, I just certain votes were divided into a simple yes or no. You couldn't overwhelm things with your sheer number of votes that you had from your population or whatever. Like when you get into the World Congress now instead of five, if you have all the city-states on lockdown, it doesn't matter. You can pass anything you want. But then there were things like the polar caps or banning the planet busters and things like that. They were just simple yes or no votes. So, you know, even if there's somebody out there who's only one city.
I think diplomacy over the years is capped by AI in any game where you have a single player and AI and a multiplayer component. Because the more complicated and dynamic you make diplomacy, the worse you make the AI at diplomacy and strategy titles.
Well, it just depends. I mean, Civ 5 Diplomacy has all sorts of diplomacy options that don't affect the game. You get handed a choice. Both choices equal the same thing.
Yeah, that's lame. I hate that.
Nothing happens.
You will pay for this in time. Screw you. Don't give me that.
It's like, actually, no, you won't, because no one cares what button you press, so why are you pressing a button?
Yeah. Yeah, those button choices is kind of like if you have a so-called recycling program and you put out blue boxes inside a building, and then when it gets outside the building, it actually just all goes in the trash.
Yeah.
Interlocking mechanics, though, too, because if you make the AI more aggressive, then you might start seeing players screw with the warmongering menace to the world stuff and getting AIs to dogpile AIs all game.
Wait, we don't do that now?
Like, worse. Like, you could trivialize that, potentially.
We're good at trivializing things on this show.
Mm. Speaking of trivial things, spies.
Well, the spies in Alpha Centauri were basically the model from the Diplomats and or spies from the previous Civ games, where you could actually do things like buy out cities and stuff like that.
Hello, Civ 2.
Yeah. Just let me wonder my Diplomat, actually, hey guys, you want to join me? I have a pile of cash.
Yeah. I think the spies in Smack were fun, but they were not balanced.
Yeah, you had the thing, and it would show you the percent chance you could get away with if you just tried to get away clean, or the percent chance if you decided you wanted to try and frame somebody else, which was actually handy at times.
Yeah?
Yeah, it was totally law, that peacenik over there that stole your technological secrets. Yep, mm-hmm.
They're the ones that bought your city that came to us. Wait, what?
Well, not that part. It was only when you were stealing tech, I think you got that.
We spoke of quantity versus quality before. Gottoclave said, Smack has more gameplay mechanics available, and they can be quite devastating. Do I miss these things in Civ 5? I think the Civ 5 implementation is quite potent and not overpowered. So the juxtaposition of those two things, I'm pretty certain he's given the nod to Civ 5.
I think that's fair.
Yeah, the Civ 5 spies are good. I just sometimes wish I had more of them, but...
No,
as fun as the lulzy BS was of previous spies, it's... really.
Yeah, let me go poison all your water supply till your city starves itself.
Before wasn't too bad, but before 4 it was really iffy.
I think spies in Civ 5 is just very thin and pretty weak for an implementation. There's just sheer lacking of stuff to do with them. I mean, yes, they've gotten better with Brave New World and stuff like that, where you can actually have diplomats and yada, yada, yada. But really, you sit there and you steal somebody's tech for the whole game.
Yeah, I agree. It could use work, but I don't want to see it become, again, the kind of nonsense it has been in the past.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, it's just more the question of if there would be more useful things to do with them other than tech steal or the random go hang out in city states to make sure that you get them in time.
Yeah, Civ 5 spy mechanics have improved since they were initially introduced, but that's like going from a 20% to a 40% on a test. It is improvement.
But you still fail.
Yeah.
Social engineering versus social policies. He's not sure what he likes more. They have different values. They have different, you know.
They do two different things.
Yeah, the social engineering in Alpha Centauri is very flexible. You can change what you're doing as the game goes on if you've researched the appropriate technology, whereas the Civ 5 social policies, you're locked into this kind of civilization. You can't really change it very much. You know, if you get into a later game where you think, well, I should have gone warmongering. I mean, you can take the ideologies, like you could take autocracy or something like that if you needed to add war in, but you can't change the whole, like, fundamental nature.
If we were talking about social engineering versus social policies before Brave New World, when they had this, hey, you cannot mix and match these particular social policies unless you want to just completely erase this progress, you know, like rationalism and piety, for example, then this would be an easier comparison for me.
Yeah.
But for now, especially when, okay, we're comparing social engineering versus social policies, we're trying to compare, like, things here, and of course the games are not the same.
Yeah.
So I think it is a more difficult question now,
yeah,
because it takes into account the greater gameplay mechanics, purpose, feel, etc. of the games.
Well, it's also the social policies themselves are no longer important for the impact on game or diplomacy or anything anymore. Now they're just like they help you towards your empire building, but it's now the ideologies that are the the push.
So if that actually said social engineering versus social policies / ideological tenets, because, yeah, you could say, oh, well, you accumulate culture and you can use that culture accumulation to adopt either one or the other once you get to the industrial age or modern era. But it's not the same when you're just talking about strictly social policies now.
Yeah, he does point out a little bit further down about there was a thing going on with certain bits of social engineering. If you had it and you had, like, he gives the example of if you had a planned economy and some other guy had a free market economy, that you'd get into conflict pretty quickly because those were sort of opposing ideologies. And we get that in the game in now in Brave New World with your autocracy. Somebody takes freedom. They're like, I hate you.
Well, and quite frankly, in Alpha Centauri, just by the very nature of the factions versus the civilizations, there already is, based on your faction and someone else's factions, right away, before you have said or done anything in the game, there is already this either positive or, in particular, negative disposition between them, just because of the nature of the game and the backstory that you have in Alpha Centauri that you don't have in Civ 5.
Yep. That's like the
super geeks versus tree huggers. Yeah, they're not going to like each other.
Or the many other games in space have the predisposition based on race. So,
yeah,
pretty common thing. On to tile improvement.
Yeah.
Tile improvement minigame. Oh, you got to give the full title. That's
tile improvement minigame.
Wow. The minigame, huh?
Yeah, he's saying that in Civ 5, there's not so many choices about what would be the optimal improvement. You get a palace or a horse, you put a pasture on it. You have a hill most of the time, unless you're the Inca, you're going to put a mine on it. But yeah, in Alpha Centauri, because of the way the terrain is, depending on how close the cities are together, whether it's a dry area or... because it had a little, you know, microclimate thing going on. Some areas were dry, some areas were had more rainfall. So the more rainfall area, you put farms over there. Dry area, maybe that's where you do mining. Is it rocky enough to do mining? There was a lot more that you had to go on with this. And then there was other special improvements, like the boreholes and big solar panel things for energy. Seriously, you actually had to think about what you were doing, not just aim worker, make farm, make mine, chop tree.
Yeah, well, that's the whole terraforming thing.
Yeah, I was about to say. And then there's the whole, hey, do I want to elevate this or sink everybody into the ocean?
Terraforming is going to be a little harder in Civ 5 just because of the way the engine works.
And also the fact that Alpha Centauri is based on, hey, guess what?
Yeah.
You're already in space.
We're not sci-fi.
Yeah, so terraforming doesn't seem like a strange idea.
Exactly.
It's interesting, though, like, Civ 5 would probably benefit more than Smack did from a dynamic improvement model because of the ICS versus not issue.
This does not mean, audience, that we are saying, are we indirectly advocating for a return to global warming effects?
No.
I don't mean that kind of we don't mean that kind of terraforming.
When I say dynamic tile improvements, I do not mean that your tile improvements become desert fairy magic. No. Not so much.
Aw, can't we have magic?
No DFM.
Desert fairy magic. That sounds like something that might work in a role-playing game, not a strategy game.
Apparently it worked in Civ 4 for people.
There are literally some things that could do with a terraformable component.
Yes. Canals especially. Why not? It has such strategic implications.
That's fine. We've talked about canals before on the show. I'm fine with that. I mean, that terraforming, there's terraforming and then there's terraforming.
Yeah.
Building canals versus let's turn desert into grassland. Say what?
And turn tundra into desert and then into grassland.
Yeah. This tile could use a hill.
So expansion and growth restriction.
Yeah.
I mean, this is actually the most interesting of all the criteria, actually.
You don't have luxury resources, but you're able to actually divert part of, because it still has all of your money going into the same pot. You could actually split some for culture and things, and so forth. You could do the same thing here. You could put some of it up to happiness. So you could prevent that, and you get this balance, and yeah.
Oh, remember reassigning citizens to be the Elvis impersonators? And
You have two ways to use some of your budget to allocate to happiness, basically. Or you can turn some of them into, well, they're not Elvises. They're something else. More like counselors or something crazy like that.
He doesn't want to explain his history of drone riots.
Well, considering one of the options for quelling a drone riot is nerve stapling, which, oh, yeah, that's an atrocity, by the way. I'm going to piss off your neighbors.
Number 5 from episode 205.
And I'm certain fan fiction will elaborate that in addition to...
No, you don't want to...
If leaders do or do not know each other, are they familiar or are they familiar with each other, if you know what we're talking about?
Why? You have to bring that in.
Full
34.
That is not the realm of podcast. I ban it. The phrase fan fiction is enough. You don't want to preface anything with fan fiction. I'm sorry. At least not publicly. Lol.
Number 4 from episode 213.
The final word or words for the show, seeing as how it was in the notes, goes to Maggie.
Give me 2 seconds to get a final word out of Elodie because she's about to die.
Well, then.
I'm not the only person playing while we're talking.
Yeah, well, I can talk and play at the same time. I do this every Saturday night when we play Civ. Normal Civ.
Me too.
How have you come to such a pass?
This is
because you wouldn't make peace. I would have let you stay on your little island by yourself, but no, you wouldn't make peace. So you get to die then.
Number 3 from episode 216.
You can go purity, but you can have a little supremacy in your life, a little harmony on the side.
Some of your friends are robots, too.
A little bit of purity is all I need.
No. I know where you're going.
I was surprised I had this quote so many lyrics from that song before anybody said anything. I was kind of disappointed.
No, I was just facepalming over here.
We had to finish the facepalming first.
I knew where you were going.
Yeah, and song lyrics.
That's only because you know me.
You think you know me.
Are you going to start singing Simply Red now, if you don't know me by now?
No. Something different in terms.
Not enough singing on Polycast. I make a move.
No.
Overrule.
No, you cannot overrule. You haven't won yet.
Won this thing off.
On the next episode of Polycast, you can only answer a topic if you sing it.
I'm singing it, Mac.
Then you'll lose, Mackie, and then you won't ever be able to regulate who sings.
Fine, let's compromise for Mackie. Next episode of Polycast, we can only answer in song lyrics.
Okay. That'd be interesting. I can make notes for that.
Oh, God.
Number 2 from episode 208.
On August 13th, Civilization II Revolution was released for Android.
Does that include Kindle? Because my mom would probably play it.
No Kindle for you.
Aww.
I'm going to have to talk to her as to why she didn't raise you to be a supremacy faction player. This is going to be an important
because
discussion.
Because she would probably also play Harmony and Hug the Aliens?
As far as you know.
Yeah, pretty much, as far as I know.
Look, Phil and Mackie, I like both of you, so since you like supremacy, Phil, and Mackie likes harmony, clearly I'm going to have to go purity, because it's the best of both worlds. I'm going to just gonna throw that out there.
Mackie, dogpile on Dan?
Yeah, dogpile on Dan.
Awesome. It might be the worst of both worlds, I don't know.
Absolutely not, Kyle. Why would you say something like that? That is a socially irresponsible statement.
Well, because you don't get cyborg implants and get to live forever, and you also don't get to merge with a planet intelligence and become one with the universe. Instead,
stop trying to have sex with the planet.
Basically, he just got he also got the memo to dogpile on Dan. That's all there is, really.
Number 1 from episode 203, as seen through Civ 4 and 5, how to approach the presence and use of peacetime armies.
topic started by, I'm going to guess the pronunciation is J-Man, but it could be just J-Heyman or something. I don't know. Apologize as always for butchering pronunciations, but know that you are not alone. You join a long list of TMIT mispronunciations, potentially. Well, I said two things, so I definitely mispronounced it at least once. So yes, you join that list. Standing Army in peacetime, rule of thumb. Thread reads, I'm trying to figure out the best size for standing defense only army in peacetime, aiming for a non-conquest domination win. Premise is average difficulty level, and in past versions of Civ, he's had a rule of thumb that two of his best units in each city, which is usually enough to slow down attackers at the beginning of a war. I would disagree with that. He read that in Civ 4, military might plays only a marginal factor in the decision of other Civs to declare war on you. What rule of thumb do you have for peacetime here? That was definitely true in Civ 4. You would have to be in a runaway position, block wars with your military might. Usually you'd had functionally won by that point. In Civ 5, all I was going to say on higher difficulty levels, essentially that's going to be true anyway because they'll be bigger than you. But I don't know about average difficulty levels. It depends how you're playing. But basically, you want to keep a, whatever you feel comfortable with that you could hold off your enemy forces, and a little bit of scouting is going to let you see your most likely attackers. And you probably should keep a standing army just from a premise of actually being able to defend yourself should you be declared on, but also from promotion. So that's the Civ 5 angle. In Civ 4, basically the way it works is that you have to be, with some AIs, almost double their military strength to prevent war. Like Montezuma is close to 200%. So you're not going to be able to do that practically. Your best approach there, well, it's actually not that different. You scout them out and you see what they have. Everybody but Tokugawa, for the most part, will open borders. And you see what kind of units they have, and then you start sticking units in a border city. Two units per city isn't really a good approach in any of the games, as far as I'm concerned, at least. I don't remember too well Civ 2. I was pretty young when I played it. But for Civ 3, Civ 4, Civ 5, if you're just throwing a couple units in each city and leaving them there, that's really not the best tactical use of your forces. The AI is pretty predictable in terms of where it will attack, and it tends to bunch up its forces there on top of it, making it even more obvious. So you really want enough units to hold that off. You have to feel that out to some degree. If you're just trying to survive a war, Montezuma is pretty different from Hammurabi or Shaka. They're all a little different, but you want enough units to hold off their offensive force, and they will stack up their stack of doom right next to you if they're going to declare on you, and they will telegraph it with, we have enough on our hands right now. If you mouse over the declare war, or if you have a mod like Bug, then it'll just show you that they're plotting a war of some kind, and you can be a little extra vigilant. But you want to get away with a minimum of units, and that's going to vary depending on the size of your enemy, your size, and whatever. There's no, like, 100% hard set rule for that. Other than that, if you have no possible enemy, you can get away without a military. Otherwise, it's probably good to have at least enough to hold off the initial attack. And you can see that via a combination of looking at the demographics to see what the army is that they have, and just getting open borders or using culture or whatever or spy to look at their military. So starting with Alphabet, you can always look at their stack just by moving a spy next to them.
A lot of people responding to Jamin's thread said that the ideal number of units per city is exactly one warrior each.
Yes.
As you mentioned, right. You can oftentimes prevent war through diplomatic means entirely. Half of the civilizations will not plot war against you at all if you're pleased, and getting to pleased is fairly easy.
Yes, although usually those guys aren't too threatening in war anyway. There are some exceptions, of course, like Mehmed. He will not plot it, please. He can be quite devastating.
By far the best defense in that game was knowing the ins and outs of the diplomatic system, how you can get points with people, and with whom those points count.
But if you draw a start with, like, Shaka and FTU, there's really not a whole lot you can do, other than if he has someone he hates even worse, and that also borders him. Because otherwise, you will trip lane target with him, because he'll settle at you. And even if he's pleased, he can declare. At that point, you need to have some units. There's no way around it. And I guess you can ask for a one gold tribute at please to buy some years of peace. Or if you are doing well in technology, you can constantly bribe him into other orbs at risk of making him huge. But ultimately, you probably want some forces. And especially on the middle difficulties, it shouldn't be that hard to wall him. Even on Immortal, when they hit you with like 10 units, it's not that bad. Especially if you find a hill city.
I think another component of standing army, amongst some others, is your economy.
being able to actually support that army. And at a certain point in time, you may find that you need to temporarily reduce your standing army. And you might be thinking, but then I'm more vulnerable to attack. But if your army is so large that you're having a significant deficit, and I'm kind of bleeding maybe a little bit in more into Civilization V here, but still, that it's crippling your ability to maintain your units anyway, and your ability to continue to produce science, to continue to hold what it is that you have, to be able to buy things, to keep people happy, then that's something you also need to take into account. When I see standing army, now maybe this is just me, but I'm thinking just that army. And depending upon the point in the game that you're at, combined with considerations of map type, as well as your neighbors, there's also like standing army and standing air force in peacetime. And I guess this kind of maybe bleeds even more into Civilization V. If it's later on and you've gotten to the point where you do have air units, then you can cut back to some degree, particularly when he's saying, right, that this is for defensive purposes. He's aiming for a non-conquest and domination win. So if you give yourself air superiority, then you're not going to need to worry about the standing army so much.
Tip 4 air units cannot kill units, with the exception of, like, guided missiles and nukes, which are different unit class. So you will want ground forces, definitely.
The idea, by the way, was that with this topic, even though it was Civ 4 focus, we would also talk about it with regards to Civilization 5. But I think even with Civ 4 versus Civ 5, it's what is your technological level as compared to your neighbors, or at least those neighbors that are going to be able to do serious damage to you. Because if you have superior technology, but they have superior numbers, you might be in trouble. And that kind of also goes to, oh, your standing army, just have them sitting in cities for happiness purposes. You're going to want to concentrate as much as your army as you possibly can, practically speaking and support-wise, where they're going to be needed for either defensive purposes or even offensive defensive purposes. I've got a really strong military, but they're spread out, and this part of my empire is being attacked. Uh-oh, now I've got to move all of them over there to be able to defend, but by the time I get over there, the AI has already taken multiple cities. They're trenched in. Maybe those were some of my really good production cities. Now what the heck am I going to do? So you've really got to have a sense of the lay of the land, where you are relative to your neighbors, your technology, your map type. Yeah, this really goes through. There is no one answer for this.
Yeah, there's something I would like to point out that's a big difference between the two games, though, and that's the cost of a standing army in each one. With the base supply of the armies in Civ 4, you can afford much. Well, I mean, it's a Deck of Doom game, not a Carpet of Doom game. It doesn't have the one unit for tile restriction. But on top of that, it's much less expensive to field an army in Civ 4 versus 5 due to the free supply you get and just that it's designed around allowing huge forces. I would routinely have 100 to 200 units in Civ 4 late game on Immortal. And yeah, it was a drain on the economy, but it wasn't even an entire lighter tick to field 200 forces. Comparing that to fielding a large army in Civ 5, it can get very expensive quickly to the point where it's forcing you to materially cut back on other things. Whereas in Civ 4, with the ways you can get gold from selling technologies and all the other ways you can get gold, it really wasn't that big of a deal to field very large armies, and one of the most common rookie mistakes in Civ 4 was to underbuild their military, just because it's hard to quantify the payback for it compared to building. You know, you can get out an Excel spreadsheet and quantify the payback time of the different buildings against your tile improvements, but with military, you always had some RNG noise there, and not to mention how quickly you could conquer things, whatever. It became much more difficult. But value proposition-wise, units are extremely powerful in Civ 4, and they're not nearly as costly as in Civ 5 either. You're going to lean a lot heavier on building military over alternatives in Civ 4 as a result.
Yeah, Civ 5 is a completely different game than Civ 4, especially when it comes to the standing army.
Yeah.
Just the cost in mid-game around, like, turn 120, 130 is 2 gold per turn per unit. If you have a tiny military, say 10 units, that's 20 gold per turn. 20 gold per turn in the Renaissance is a huge amount of money. You can bribe maybe 2 AI to do whatever you want with it. You can, like, buy a couple of buildings. You can do a whole ton of things with that money. And you also save on hammers if you just don't have a military at all. So even on deity level, I think a standing army is one of the most inefficient things that you can have. And I'm going to differentiate that from a defensive army and an aggressive army. So a defensive army is when you know you're about to be attacked. He has the red marks. He covets your land. You've trapped him. He's going to attack. You know this. He's, like, not sending you trade routes, even though you're his only trading partner. Like, that's the biggest red flag. If he would rather trade with, like, a city-state than you, you know you're getting attacked. Then in that case, you kind of have to have a defensive army or else you're going to die. But short of that, if you can just anticipate what the AI is going to do, you don't need an army at all on deity level, I would say at least 90% of the time. A standing army is more of a crutch. It's safe, because if you have one and the AI attacks, you're still sort of fine. But if you can just read, like, 20 turns ahead when the AI is going to attack you, then you can build the defensive army at the time when you actually need it and save on all this gold upkeep and save on all the hammers and have, like, very modern units for whatever time period you need to defend it. And the other option is an aggressive army, which you don't have to take over anything. You don't have to have expansionist policies, but you can pillage for gold. You can attack people for diplo with other nations. There's usually one civilization that everyone hates. So if you just, like, attack them a little, like, kill a couple of their units with your army, you get good diplo modifiers with everyone else, which then gets you better deals, all this good stuff. So there's a use for an aggressive army and a use for a defensive army, but a standing army, fairly a bad play for Civ 5.
I don't play Civ 5 that frequently, to say the least. What do you do when you have a well-promoted unit from an early game war, then?
Well, you can save a couple of well-promoted units, especially if you're going tradition. The free garrison policy is very good because then you have no upkeep. If you had to have a unit and you got involved in some kind of war, or this is just one of your earliest units and it's just been through a lot, you can keep them with tradition, or even on Liberty or Piety Star, a small drain on your economy, because you can't just build that unit again. But for most of your army, you should disband it. That's kind of a radical idea, I think, that people don't usually do. But after I do a plausible rush, if I'm not doing tradition, or after even an artillery rush, I would just disband my army, almost all of my army, because I've established this diplomatic position where I know I'm not going to get attacked. And so this army just costs gold, just standing there. It's going to cost gold to upgrade. The only use for these extra units at that point is that you can reserve archaeology spots, which is really nice. So as soon as you discover archaeology, you can just plant these units all over the world until your archaeologists actually get there. But besides that, I mean, after the scouting portion, you just don't see a lot of use for units in a peaceful game.
Honorable mention from episode 197.
Kind of a not so much what you face in life, but how you respond to it and how these companies respond to it and when they respond to it, I think will be a big test of when people look back on the announcement of this service shutting down, how negatively or positively it is viewed.
You make it sound like GameSpy has terminal cancer and we're getting all philosophical about its imminent passing.
I'm just starting to write a post-mortem, that's all. I mean,
we knew this was coming, had a good run, and we should all learn from this experience.
You have a problem with my trying to turn some lemons into lemonade, Izzy?
No, it just makes me sad.
Oh, well, no, I mean, that's quite understandable, and I'm certain there's some people out there listening to this show, and they're like, what's GameSpy? Why are we talking about this?
And number one from episode 196.
You know exactly what I'm doing. Speaking of lists...
No. I say we cut that one.
No. It's too late. I already talked about doing a list.
We've already had a list, though. You gave us a list of things from the survey, so we've already done our list quota for the day. Nope.
Yeah. No, this is the top 10. You gotta have the top 10. Gotta have the top 10.
No, we don't.
Ha! Already done. So sad. Too bad for you.
Not a top 10.
You will survive.
You will survive.
All right. You know what? The only way to settle this is to ask our guests. So, guests of the three intro outro topics, let's just let us neutral party decide. This episode is long enough already.
I would like you to know that depending on your answer, you may or may not ever come back.
Mackie said that, not me. I don't know why she'd play that card. That's pretty cool.
Because people think you're a nice guy and all Canadian, but really, you're ruthless, man.
Call it today.
In North America, 301-637-7659.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
Log on to the series' official website at
thepolycast.net.
Thank you for tuning in to Polycast Evergreen, Season 8. I'm about to locate the Snyders. Negotiation was irrelevant.
Civilization 1 clips copyright Microprose.
Civilization 4 sound clips copyright Take 2 Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.